This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Jim Reese is here. He's come from South Dakota all the way to read you this poem. Here's Jim.
This poem is called Ready Action. I'm standing in line at the mega pharmacy waiting to buy drugs. I know, I don't like this place, but it's handy and cheap. Standing in the slow line, I can't keep my eyes off the prophylactic section. Two young guys with bottles of five-hour energy shrug shoulders, laugh, turn to look at who might be staring at them, joke louder, turn back to the KY and rows of Trojans and lifestyles while they fondle the Astroglide. Don't be such a numbnut, one says to the other as they snicker and turn their cart down the aisle. Soon enough, they are back, intent this time on grabbing the right product. Then off they go, bearing their goods in a large, half-empty cart that in a couple of years they will fill with formula, baby wipes, diapers, Aquaphor healing ointment, disinfectant wipes, lead paint test kits, hand sanitizers, lots of sugar-free juice, binkies, tearless shampoo, a pack and play, a bouncy seat, pregnancy tests, colored condoms, acid reducers, band-aids, Ativan, peroxide, and tonic. The cart will overflow, and that will only be the beginning. Today, though, none of that matters. They race for the only male checkout clerk who, God willing, will let them pass through with hard-earned cash without asking for their IDs or if they need to speak with the pharmacist about practical application, correct procedures, or any other instruction they've never wanted or been given.
Jim Reese, we are so glad you came so far. He's our Mark Twain
of
this century. He's the author of four books of poetry or more.
This is the third book.
Okay. But how about Really Happy?
That's
your third book.
Yep.
And some of the others, how about Wedding Cake and Funeral Ham?
Yeah, I guess that's a chapbook.
Three Trespasses.
Yep, These Trespasses and
Ghost on Third. That makes four. And we're going to be hearing from all of them, I hope. And Jim writes about the everyday experience. And he, in my view, is therefore America's poet. Give us one more poem so they can judge for themselves, Jim.
Well, this is one that I wrote just recently. It's called Honey-Do List. Shirtless, the men in the neighborhood put down the remotes, sit upright in their recliners, and come out of hibernation. It's time to wage war with noxious weeds in their yards, drag dead branches and trash cans full of God knows what to the curb. Think about initiating workout routines. Stroll around the perimeters of their houses, inventorying all their stuff, and remembering their honey-do lists. Take the holiday lights down. Recycle the beer cans. Replant the garden. Repair the leaky faucet. Replace the window. Do something with their no-shave November beards, which are old and itchy. They are acutely aware of the smell of grill smoke and Roundup weed killer in the air, the feeling of fertilizer pellets in the soles of their shoes. The neighborhood is green again. The men buy new razors and take hedge clippers and chainsaws from the top shelves of their garages. Running out of things to cut down is a pressing dilemma for the American male. They stretch out their favorite t-shirts, pulling them down over their stomachs as they bend for a few air squats. They floss teeth, brush grill grates, the windows open, the Harley's humming. It's summer in suburbia. Women run out in sunglasses and spandex, showing off the first skin of spring, the men pacing and ready to clear paths, sucking in their guts, already lying to themselves.
The first skin of spring, Jim Reese. He's assistant professor of English at Mount Marty College in Yankton, South Dakota. And he's been writer in residence at Yankton Federal Prison for more than 9 years. But since he's our poet, I want to keep with his poetry for one more poem.
You mentioned Mount Marty College, and I'll read this real quick. This is about me in the classroom. This is called Black Words on White Paper. I'm grading freshman essays. Too many papers about exhaustive road trips without hitchhikers. anorexia, the death penalty, abortions. One, about the future farmers of America. You don't have to grow up in the country to be a member. I never knew that. Most essays about families say they are dysfunctional. They always are. But sometimes, it still scares me what students reveal. Like when Carlos writes, "That night when my father pointed his hunting rifle at my head and said he was going to put a bullet between my eyes, I knew I had to say something. That's the first time I used my voice to make a difference." The phone rings and it's Willow. "Dad," she says, her voice shaky and exhilarated, "can I get my ears pierced?" At that moment, she could have asked for a pony and I'd have given it to her. How exciting it is to hear a child's anticipation, the delight instead of darkness.
Jim Reese, you do more than teach English in those classrooms. And what I like about you the most is I don't really know how men think except through poetry. I didn't have brothers, and I had one husband who was not typical because he was a visual artist. And when I hear a male poet talk about the pellets and the fertilizer and the lawn, I know what a man is. That's really quite a contribution, Jim. I don't know if you're speaking for all men, but you do value the male experience. Am I right about that?
I hope so. I mean, I'm doing the best I can. Here's a poem about becoming men. This is called 707 Florence Boulevard. Is where we used to go buy beer back in high school. We used to just go to the corner liquor store until Vernon got smart and made us pick him up at his apartment. We always had to have an extra $5 to get him his pint of Skol. The apartment with its flaking light blue walls smelled like a sweaty ass. My friend wouldn't even sit on the couch until he passed out on it. We stayed, always stayed too long. There was no art on the walls, just his daughter's honor roll certificates and a turntable in the corner spinning 45s. We ate gizzards there. We drank and sang, and we danced with Vernon's wife until she talked dirty to us. And the night she asked another friend to feel her up and he didn't, the night she stabbed Vernon in the stomach because he couldn't get it up, that was the last time we bought beer on a regular basis.
Well, that tells us a lot about men. And teacher, father, writer in the prisons. When did you first put your passion to work in the prison? What triggered you to know that you could go in there and do something? How did that happen?
You know, it was somebody from the prison came to our college and wanted to know if anybody had experience with publishing books and editing and writing, and so it was that easy. I had a dean at the time that made that connection, and so I started right away at the prison. And what we have is an interagency initiative with the Federal Bureau of Prisons and the National Endowment for the Arts. So there's six of us throughout the country that work in this program. So I just looked and did some research on what all the other programs were doing, and I started our program in Yankton, South Dakota at Federal Prison Camp Yankton, and made sure that my goal was to publish a book every year, which we've done now for the last 9 years.
It's a fabulous anthology. What's the title?
It's called 4 p.m. Count. If you go by a federal prison anywhere in the country at 4 p.m., you won't see anybody. That's because they're getting counted.
And the guys on the cover have such a look of self-esteem and pride, which I know they did not have before. But, Jim, it sounds easy. Okay, so the dean did this, and I went in there, and that was fine. You must have had some trepidations before you went in. You must have had some confusion about how you would be received or success. Shirley, what were your feelings?
There was two things. When I first started, too, one of the things that they did was the first or second year, they took us into San Quentin prison for training. So even though we worked in federal prisons, we went to California to San Quentin and learned a lot if you go into a prison like that or to New Folsom. Those are some pretty hardcore prisons. So that kind of shocked us, to be honest with you. I was nervous, obviously. You're signing waivers. that say we will not negotiate for you in a hostage situation. So those are that was kind of how it started. And then you would learn watch how the arts programs were working there, which are a great thing for people if they're incarcerated. And the fact is that we have just so many people in this country that are incarcerated, over 2 million, about 2.3. Mm-hmm. So that's we did that. And then also, like I said, I did some research. And then I went in, what I did as a teacher, you know, I went in and I was really overprepared. So the biggest lesson I learned was these guys really want their voice to be heard. So I had to just really back off and be quiet. And so I worked with each class for about 10 months.
With the same guys
for 10 months, and then we publish a book, and then we start the cycle all over again. So that was my biggest lesson.
And you don't see them again after 10 months? It's one group, each group?
Yeah, unless there might be a couple that come back to class, but most of them are new students. And
they're hand-picked, I'm sure.
The only requirement is they have to have a GED. They have to have passed their GED to come into this class. So
9 years.
So far, yeah.
And Jim.
And hopefully another 9.
What do you feel now that you look back at your first year? What can you say, what changes have you really made?
Well, I think, you know, if you say to a writer, hey, you want to go into this prison and do a reading, most of them will say, yeah, because they think it's cool. And I think once that wore off, you know, then I really started asking myself, what am I doing here? Why am I doing this? And, you know, I've never had an experience. I've never been more thankful as a teacher to teach in a place like that because it's just so rewarding.
Oh.
You know, I can give you one example in another one here. Maybe I'll read this to you. But to have like a 63-year-old man tell me, hey, you know, I've been bottling this stuff up all these years. I have grandkids and I've never told anybody about this. And to get them to unlock that door and to write their stories, it's really healing for them. It's healing for their families. It's healing for the country.
You have some wonderful poems that have come out of this experience. Would you read one of them to us? This is Jim Rees from South Dakota. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and we're at the Library of Congress.
This is called Sunshine, Handcuffs, Plexiglass Scars. See these flowers, an inmate says. They're closed at night, and in the morning they open. They stay open most of the day. I don't know what they're called, but I get to see them open and close. I had these same flowers by my front steps. The stems feel plastic, almost fake. They break easily, and we aren't supposed to touch them here. You know, one of the prisons they had me at, I could step into a corner of my cell and get a sliver of sunlight. It would hit me right here. He cranes his neck and closes his eyes. Right here on my face for about a half an hour. That was the only sunlight I'd see. It's mental deprivation. It works. Hell, most guards don't know what you're in for. They don't care. We were loaded on a 747 one winter, and we were standing on the tarmac without any jackets, a bunch of us. Just a t-shirt, orange pants, no socks, no shoes. They had our legs chained at the ankles so tight I was bleeding all over my feet, freezing. Scars are still here. And he puts his leg on the bench and pulls down his sock to show me. You know, I'm no killer or sicko. My whole stint that got me here lasted only 5 months. That's how long it took to hit bottom, hanging out with some terrible people I thought were my friends, and I backslid down the whole way that fast. Meth will eat you up. 15 years, I'll be down for an addiction I couldn't shake, could have never imagined. When my daughter used to come visit me, I'd be behind those glass partitions. She'd tell me, Daddy, roll down this window. I'd say, I can't, honey. She'd ask, when are you going to come home? Soon, I'd tell her. Now she wants to know the date. She'll be graduated by then.
Jim Rees, roll down this window. Roll down this window. So it has to take some toll on you, Jim. How do you prevail?
You know, I just got to remind myself I'm just a teacher. And you know what? These guys are, the truth is, these guys are men. They've made some mistakes. I'm a man. I've made plenty of mistakes myself. And the alarming thing is, and the more I do this, the more I understand that, you know, I can, here's a shocking statistic that just came out from a fact sheet from the White House in the last couple months, but, you know, it says around 70 million Americans have some sort of criminal record, and almost 1 in 3 Americans of working age have that criminal record. So 1 in 3 have a criminal record, and 1 in every 31 adults, or 3.2% of the population, is under some sort of correctional control. Those are alarming statistics.
Well, when you think that the most generous nation in the world has the most people in prison, we have 5% of the world's population and 30% of the people in prison.
25% of its inmates.
What do you make of that?
Well, something needs to change. And what we know, you know, what the listeners don't know is that I you know, I walk around with these statistics, you know, that we have right in front of me. But what we know, and the only thing that we know that works, is education. And if you can, you know, basically, something I heard when I was in San Quentin early on was, you can lock a person up and let them out after so long, and maybe during their incarceration, you teach them a trade, and that's great. But what you also have to do is help them tap into emotional instabilities that brought them to prison in the first mm-hmm. place. Writing, art, and, you know, more importantly, education and corrections helps open that door. If a person never comes to terms with themselves, you're just going to send an angry person right back out into society. And that, you know, we know that, and we know that just locking somebody up doesn't work. So,
and finally, we know that 20% of the people in prisons have disabilities that are not being taken care of, even deafness, blindness, and inability to communicate, which is what got them in trouble in the first place. So when people say to you, oh, that's great, so you're giving them a hobby, what mm-hmm. do you say back?
Well, I'm not giving them a hobby. I really want them to tap into those emotional instabilities, because it makes them better people. It makes their environment better for the people that are incarcerated and for the people that are working in corrections. It makes families better. It makes healing better. And the truth of the matter is, you know, what we see on TV, you know, heinous crimes in the federal system, statistics are, you know, it's less than 3% of people in the federal system commit heinous crimes. Mm-hmm. 48.7%, I believe it is, are in there for drug-related crimes. So that tells me...
a health problem.
You know, there's a real addiction problem in mm-hmm. the United States.
Mm-hmm. Jim Reese, who is an example of a poet who is more than poetry. And please give us a poem.
This is kind of about that, what we're talking about. This is called This Isn't Dress Rehearsal. It's 53 degrees this afternoon. Tomorrow, time will spring ahead. In 5 minutes... the still obnoxiously loud grade school bell will alarm the neighborhood. In line at the chain link fence with some of the other fathers who have shown up, I'm waiting for you, my daughters. Today, recess should never end. In 2 months, one of you will leave this place for middle school, the other ascend to second grade. Some things never change. I claw my hands into the chain link that seems so much shorter now. I see the tire swing, the basketball hoop without a net, black top and worn tetherball. I'm not old enough to wish I were back in your shoes, not with the math homework you're assigned. But there's the aching for some of that freedom. Maybe that's why none of the fathers standing here say a word. And when I shared the rough draft of this poem in class, a prisoner said, you know, that's one fence I never minded being behind. Girls, do you know how much I'm going to miss these days, this magical moment on all our faces when we see each other between these boundaries waiting to go home?
Jim Reese, that's why I love you, because you take the everyday experience and elevate it to art.
Thanks.
And I want to know how you teach your students to do that. How you teach them that the needle in the crotch of your jeans that somebody was just sewing for you is still there. How the thong in the classroom is seen through the slacks. How you, William Carlos Williams would say, see the broken green glass on the cement and know that that's a poem. You have the gift to know that the ordinary is holy. But how do you partake this? How do you give this to a student?
The main thing is just keeping your eyes open. Ted Kooser, when I was, right before he became United States Poet Laureate, and then when he was the Poet Laureate, and then, you know, I still work with him. He's a really great guy. But he would come into our class, and he would do this simple exercise. He would just say, hey, write down 5 things you noticed today. In the last hour, write down 5 things. And when you ask a student to do that, or if you ask anybody to do that, they just look at you blankly, and they don't know. It takes them a little while to actually think about what they're looking at. And now it's gotten a lot worse. You know, everybody's looking down the whole time. So I don't want to get on that soapbox, but, you know, I think it's just paying attention to what's around you and really enjoying what's around you.
And making them value the smallest thing.
Yeah.
Because it does. I think they come in thinking high art is about Mount Olympus and clouds and sand. But the needle.
And I've never done any of that. You know, I've never been to Mount Olympus. I don't have sand around me. It's
the needle in the crotch.
Yeah,
that's poetry. That is poetry.
People don't know what you're talking about. That's a funny. That is funny. That's a poem about my mother-in-law who. Yes.
Well, give us a poem. We're at the Library of Congress, and I'm Grace Cavalieri.
This is called The Keeper of All Things Whole and Necessary. Puts leftover food in little plastic baby food containers and yogurt cups she has hoarded. Will leave half a chicken wing for someone else to eat. Wraps up and refrigerates one slice of bacon. Puts lemon juice on half an apple so it won't turn brown. Washes and pack rats straws with holes and plastic silverware with broken tines. Has a drawer full of mustard, barbecue, and soy sauce packages from takeout restaurants from out of town. Has personalized greeting cards that she will white out and reuse. She cuts coupons, sometimes expired. Cuts up and collects newspaper articles if she knows someone in the article or knows someone who knows the person in the article. She gives me play-by-plays of garage sales and auctions. Saves fresh scraps for stray cats and bones for the dogs. Saves for Jesus and saves for you. Picks green tomatoes before the first winter freeze and wraps them in tissue paper. Serves them for Thanksgiving dinner. Balances soap dispensers upside down like others do with ketchup bottles and eventually combines them in one. She has a room full of old jeans in case her husband's overalls need patching or her son-in-law's crotch blows out. Makes pie crust from hog lard. Has full canning jars from the 80s, has unidentifiable things older than dirt in her deep freeze. Once, I saw her pull a tarp for a pickup bed out from underneath her dresser. I've been holding on to this, I don't know how long. If you need something, a blowtorch, nunchucks, twist ties, propane, a chandelier, goat cheese, a curtain rod, a spare tire, bell bottoms, a bowling ball, anything. She's your woman.
What's the title of that
poem?
That's
called The Keeper of All Things Whole and Necessary.
And that's your mother-in-law.
Yes.
Okay, you've named what she is. We've got a character study.
Okay.
Now, what does this mean to you?
You know, she's just an interesting person. She's a great person, just like so many people in my family. And I just like writing about the people that are close to me.
Do you think those things are idiosyncratic? I mean, after all, to me, she was born in the Depression, right?
Yeah.
And those things, I believe they're a matter of her esteem. Making things match. Getting the soap in the right jar so that's to the top.
Exactly.
That's what self-esteem is, Jim.
Yep.
We're at the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. I'm with Jim Reese. Let's have another poem.
Okay. This is, if you tell everybody I'm from South Dakota... I grew up in Nebraska. That could scare some people a little bit.
How far is it from South Dakota?
I live right on the border, so I usually run from South Dakota to Nebraska. If I'm going out running, I can just cross a bridge, which
that's
is
how
a mile.
Kooser gets into your place.
Yeah, he lives down in southeast Nebraska, and I live I live right above northeast Nebraska. So,
are you a Great Plains poet?
That's where I'm from.
Okay,
yeah.
Go give it to us.
So this title was originally called, or it is called, So This Is Nebraska. Pa said Bobby and me could go fishing down at Snake Creek just as soon as we graft this here calf and finish stacking round bales up in the loft of the barn. Pa said we could go play with the Indians down the road, too, but Ma won't let us on account of man sits in tree, is still fixing to finish skinning a buffalo and make himself a new teepee today. So today, like most days, we'll likely watch them big airplanes blow by overhead. I wish people would just stop every now and again for a visit. I was fixing to go walk up the hill and pick some cherries, but Bobby got a tick up in his britches, stuck to his nutsack. Ma said maybe he was up there doing more than picking cherries and won't let none of us go up the hill no more. And Ma predicts the Pony Express is due to arrive this week. Maybe Bobby and I can go sit at the end of the lane and wait for him and his horse. It's really nifty to see him race by and toss Bobby our stack of mail. And sometimes even, there's a Sears Roebuck catalog with girly pictures for us to look at in the outhouse. And maybe, just maybe, we could take the buggy to town and get us some candy, stare at all them city folk with their fancy hats and boots. And maybe, just maybe, we could take on a picture show while Pa does his business around town. Maybe Loretta Swinson will be there in town, too. Yes'm, yes'm, I do believe she's true.
That might be a satire, but there's more truth than facts in that, and that's a perfect poem to stop with. This is the voice you've been hearing of Jim Reese, and the program is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Reva and David Logan Foundation and the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.